So we're recording. Here we go. On this episode of Watch Party PHL podcast, we're celebrating Black History Month. We'll be speaking with Randy Butler, Vice President of Program and Impact for Philadelphia Youth Basketball, and Janine Kayembe-Oro, coach mentor at PYB and the founder of Black Women's Basketball League. We'll be talking about the legacy and impact that Black women from Philadelphia have on basketball and sports in this city and around the country. Stay tuned.
And that was with an all-Black team and all-Black coaching staff. So there's something to Philadelphia's Black culture that also has a long legacy of winning, of intentionality, and of hard work.
Watch Party PHL podcast is a bi-weekly, Philly-centric podcast celebrating women's sports in the diverse community that supports them. Brought to you in partnership with Stand Apart, a friend of Watch Party PHL and the women's sports community. Each episode highlights local stories, shining a spotlight on women-owned, Black-owned, LGBTQ-owned businesses and organizations that advocate for and empower women in sports throughout the city. From grassroots efforts to professional leagues, Watch Party PHL podcast is dedicated to amplifying the voices and the stories of athletes, entrepreneurs, and community leaders working to elevate women's sports in Philly and around the country. If you love women's sports and you love Philly, this podcast is for you because everyone listens to this John. I'm here, episode 2 of the Watch Party podcast, with Randy Butler, VP of Program and Impact for Philadelphia Youth Basketball, and Janine Kayembe-Oro, coach mentor of PYB and the founder of the Black Women's Basketball Museum. Did I get all that right?
Yeah.
All right. So thank you guys for coming on today. I'm really excited about this. I'm going to give a little background real fast to how all this got started. So back in December, Watch Party had a table at the Big Five Philly tournament, the women's basketball tournament for Villanova, Drexel, Temple, St. Joe's, and LaSalle. We were there at Villanova, beautiful facility, watching some great women ballers. And Janine was there with some of her kids from PYB, Philly Youth Basketball. They stopped by the table and we got to talking about PYB, and I've been following them on Instagram for years, love what they do, and had been wanting to reach out, but just, you know, haven't had time. And so when she stopped by our table, we started talking. She threw out a couple ideas for collabing. We met a couple times, we talked a couple times, and then like a week ago, we went there and we did a watch party / Black History Month / National Girl and Women's Sports Day event at PYB. And it was so dope. There was a panel of some legendary women's basketball players from Philly, like Yolanda Laney. Help me out.
Janita Landry. And Lillian Penn.
Yes. And it was just such a great experience. But that's kind of how this got started. And I want to bring in Janine right now. Talk to us about your background in basketball, your background in Philly, PYB, and then most especially the Black Women's Basketball Museum that just started. In any order.
Cool. Well, I've actually been talking to a few different friends that know me as an artist. I am a social practice artist here in the city, which means my work has always been related to some sort of social justice issues. As a young person, I played basketball from a really young age up until high school. I played varsity at Rancho Cucamonga High School and at A.B. Miller High School, about an hour outside of L.A. And
so the L.A. is where you grew up?
Yep, L.A. is where I grew up. Between L.A. and between what's called the Inland Empire, which is like an hour outside of L.A., between my mom and my dad's. And I played basketball at both, whether it be for rec leagues in L.A. or played AAU, travel ball, all of that good stuff. And then in high school, I had a really good friend, Glenda Proby, and she is an amazing rapper and just musician overall and really inspired me. She got signed at a young age. And I was also a poet and artist, and we played basketball together. And she left to become more serious about her art. And I told my coach I wanted to pursue my art as well. And my coach at the time, Coach Jackman, said, you know, you have to either be a basketball player or you have to be an artist. And I knew that my path was really as an artist. As much as I love basketball and as much as I was connected to the game, I had a family member that played number four for the Los Angeles Sparks, Mwadi Mabika.
Nice.
I went to the games all the time. I was at the first game. I was at the game when Lisa dunked at the Coliseum. And
that's amazing.
You know, just it was just kind of in my life. And then from there, I have had an incredible artistic career. And my artistic career has sat at the intersection of like Black racial justice around Black and brown liberation, as well as climate justice. I started an urban farm in North Philly at the age of 19. And my job there was to make sure the farm was connected to arts communities. There's a graffiti wall, there's murals, all different types of ways that art can be expressed in a green space.
What was the name of that farm?
The name of the farm is called Life Do Grow, and the organization was called Urban Creators. That's where I met Zuri, who's the head director of Older Year Programs at Youth Build now. She was working at Youth Build, and we were working on diversion programs with young people to take on urban farming instead of being sentenced to prison. And, you know, from there, kind of went into arts administration, but kind of refell in love with basketball as the whole surge was coming back in the, you know, early in 2020 and beyond and to now. But during that time, I've always just kind of had basketball memorabilia from Wadi's jersey as my first piece of my collection, and things would just come to me. When I started the farm, I won a competition where Magic Johnson flew me out. I got to interview him. I got to meet his whole like Black women front office of his foundation. I sat courtside at the Laker game in his seat. Got to meet Kobe.
Come on.
It was when Dwight Howard was there. So it wasn't the best of times, but us. And then Magic Johnson, he gave me and my friend that I got to bring in the cameraman jerseys, hoodies, one of one, just like Dodger hat, fine Dodger ball. Even from the farm, we got honored at a 76ers game, and they gave me a piece of the floor from Wilt Chamberlain's 100-point. So all of these little things just would start to come to me. And then I was like, okay, maybe let me start collecting seriously, because I see that the value Black women's history, when I'm looking at eBay, when I go to little trade shows, or when I go to the games itself, the Black women's jerseys are usually cheaper. The Juju's rookie card, not even her rookie card, her All-American McDonald's game card was $1.99. But Juju Watkins has nothing to do with the $1.99. You know, so I started to see that I know the value of this history. I know the value of these items. And because my wife is an archivist, I really talk with her to understand, what does it take to collect history? What does it take to tell these stories in a way that is historically correct, historically factual, and bringing my artist and creativity side to it, is what kind of mashed up my love for basketball and art. Is really what created the museum.
Nice. Okay, so tell me about the museum then. It's not a physical museum, right?
It's not a physical museum. Right now it's just my private collection that I'm making public and taking on tour to different cities across the country and partnering with different, really, from what I've seen, Black women-led basketball leagues or programs. We went to Miami and I got to meet some really cool folks doing that have a basketball, a women's basketball league there called Bees. I'm going to Oakland next week to work with the Women's Premier Basketball Association, who's ran by Fatima Amin-Ra's, an amazing Black woman basketball player. Their team just won second place at the FIBA, International Games. And that's the Bay Area Phoenix, just like women, also women doing their thing internationally. So we're going to do a similar event like we did on Wednesday with panelists and showing the collection. And that's in collaboration with Black Joy Parade. So I'm trying to really be at the intersection of like Black women's history, basketball, women's sports in general, and showing how the pieces of my collection connect to these stories.
Nice. Cool. Yeah. And I saw some of your pieces on Wednesday when we did our National Girls and Women Sports Day event, and it was really amazing just to see the history and everything that you've collected so far, right? All right, Randy, tell me about what you do at PYB. Tell me a little bit about PYB. Tell me about your background, and then tell me about the shirt you're wearing.
I'm going to just say it right now.
I am
not going to be as cool as Janine. Jay, you're just like the epitome of women's basketball, and we could go down a whole rabbit hole, so I'll introduce myself first. But women, female basketball players, like, have always had to be an athlete plus more. And every time you tell me about that with your coach saying that you had to be the artist or the player, and I'm like, come on, coach. Every WNBA player has to be more than just the female athlete because of where we are. Now that's growing a little bit more where I can just be the women's basketball player, but we've had to be so much more. So that hurts me to hear you say that sometimes, but it is the reality of, you know, some of the things that women have to go through. So quick little rant there.
No, a well-deserved rant.
But yeah, Randy Butler, working at PYB. I'm originally from Chicago. So let me start with my story here. I'm an implant, as they call it here in Philly. Grew up playing basketball my entire life. And for me, it was really just the joy of being able to hang out with my friends, bust them up after school, in the driveway, in the alleys, and the boys for sure, because they got the work bad. And I just loved playing the game. And I feel like I was very fortunate because my parents put me in a lot of different activities. But basketball was the one that really stuck. And then when I like found this joy of just having pure fun, it's a thing that has really been the North Star for me through all my years of playing and now into my career. So I played at Colgate University, a small school in upstate New York, and sadly had a career-ending injury where I dislocated my ankle. And for me, the dream was always to be Monica from Love and Basketball. That was the dream. And I was like, I don't care how injured I am still going to get overseas and play for at least a year. And so I was luckily able to do that with the injury and all, cut my time in half, went over and joined a wonderful program where I got my master's. I got to play semi-professionally, and then I also got to work in the community using basketball as a tool to bridge.
Where'd you play?
I played in Ireland, Northern Ireland. And
nice.
So, yeah, I got to use all, I feel like I had all my passions of community ball and education really boiled up into this organization called Sport Changes Life. That was just 1 year. And so when I was like, all right, my year's coming to an end, what do I do next? I was then introduced to PYB, Philadelphia Youth Basketball. And so I literally spent 1 week in PYB summer camp volunteering as a coach mentor. And when I learned about really what this vision was for this organization to use the game of ball to really create access, exposure, and opportunity for youth, I was like, oh, I'm there. So I went for a week, learned about the vision. I said, please take me. I always feel like I am lucky and fortunate because I did enter at a time when the organization was expanding. And so I packed every little thing I had up from Chicago and I moved to Philly and I've been here ever since. And for me, that is the basketball is the cool part, right? But it is everything that the organization is providing for young people. And it is exactly that. It's access. You know, there are no barriers to entry, whether you have zero or little interest in playing ball, you get introduced to it. So we're really helping to grow the game. We're also trying to give opportunity and access to the game that is not necessarily an athlete. So you don't have to choose between being an artist or a ball player, but you can actually be both. And we want you to be both, right? We talk about the statistics of folks who actually make it, you know, that 1% that actually makes it to the leagues. Like, no, we definitely want to cultivate the skills and we want to know what your interests are and really grow them. So basketball is just that entry point, but then it's just the expanding of the artist that's in Jay or the entrepreneur that's in Little Randy and really helping them grow that. And yeah, we could still play some ball as well. A little bit about the shirt that I'm wearing here. I will represent it because it's for my girls. Hoopers is one of our girls empowerment initiatives that we really like to stand on here at the organization. So Hoopers was really birthed out of when I moved to Philly in 2017. There's some things I learned, which I don't even want to say because that's not where we are now. But I was learning and I heard this notion that I couldn't believe that girls basketball was a dying sport in the city. And I was like, whoa, because where I come from, this pure joy of playing ball just for the fun of it, that was so drastically different. And when I was going to our programmings, we had young ladies who were attending programming, they were getting involved. But when it came time for gameplay, we would ask, well, why aren't you girls participating in the gameplay? And we would get the answers of, the boys aren't passing me the balls, or it's getting a little too rough, or some of the stigmatism that goes along with girls being competitively in the games. So Hoopers was really created for our young ladies to have a space of their own, to really dominate the court, to be surrounded by other young ladies who are interested in the game, who wanted to play. And from 17 now, what year is it, 25? What we've seen is the girls growing to even want to go play with the guys again because they're feeling confident, because they have coach mentors like Jay who are like lifting them up, telling them that they can go and they can play co-ed or they can play on their own. So it's been a journey and I'm giving you little pieces of it now, but it's definitely been a journey and seeing how when you take a group of young ladies and really cherish and develop and build relationships with them, listen to them, see what the things that they want to do, who they want to be, it has grown and will continue to grow as we continue to build up our girls' empowerment.
A transition. I wanted to, Jay, talk a little bit about the history of women's basketball in Philly. Specifically, talk about the people that were on our panel since you were the moderator on the panel last week. Talk about their connection to women's basketball and Philly, because I like to say that Philly has its tentacles in all things basketball, but more importantly, women's basketball. Even if you're not from Philly, somehow you have your tentacles in the scene in Philly, whether you're a coach here, whether you are an implant here because of a job that you got with a basketball organization, I feel like where it may have been dying in 2017, prior to that and now, Philly's an important part of the basketball scene, especially the women's basketball scene. So can you talk a little bit about the history that was on our panel that kind of set that path for us?
Yeah. So believe it or not, the women's basketball did not begin with the WNBA. My research has taken me all the way back to the early 1900s. Remember, basketball was created in like 1840s, late 1840s. It was predominantly white sport. And then black women were allowed to play once HBCUs come into effect in history and once women are allowed to play in sports. So we're talking about the early 1900s, 1910s, 1920s. And, you know, predominant sports then were definitely track and field, tennis, and I think the seed of women's basketball starts with what I guess you could call as, it wasn't called the Negro League like baseball, but you could call it what would be a Negro League. They had one for the men's, and of course they had one for the women's. And it would be really tied to like churches and rec centers in black neighborhoods, like Germantown, mm-hmm. like South Philly, North Philly. And as I'm starting to meet different women, specifically elders who played basketball in Philadelphia, they're always like, oh, you don't know about this girl. You don't know about her. You don't know about... And, you know, and these are like my OGs. So if my 50 plus homies are saying, you don't know about her from back in the day, then that means they're about 60 plus. And then we got to meet Coach Jones, who's probably in her 70s. So now, I mean, I can't do the math in this moment, but we're talking about like the 40s and 50s. And we're talking about black women playing basketball and hooping. The most famous, of course, you guys just put on your t-shirt and hoodies, or Mae Washington. She's a tennis star, and my favorite fact about her is that I think in her 40s, she beat Althea Gibson, which we know is one of the best black tennis players, young Althea Gibson, but that's how talented she was. She was a tennis champion and then moved on to play basketball. And as I'm reading some of the newspaper
clippings. And dominated clipping, in basketball, mm-hmm. too.
Mm-hmm. Oh, absolutely dominated yeah. in basketball. As I'm reading some of the newspaper clippings, I'm like, they were just out there punching each other in the gut and tripping. Like, there was, the rules were totally different, and it was very aggressive and very, you know, there was only ones and twos. So really competitive, right, to get to these points. And Ora Mae Washington, they won numerous, I think it was like 11 or 12 back-to-back championships, and they were playing predominantly other black cities like Baltimore, like Chicago. You had the New York Bells, I think they were called. Here was the Tribune Girls, but they were called the Hot Steppers. Then you got the Chocolate Ladies down in Baltimore. So there was kind of this like, in black music, you have something called the Chitlin Circuit, which are safe black cities for people to play music at. And it seems like the basketball circuit, the sports circuit, also followed some of these black cultural strategies in order to be able to play basketball safely, right? Ora Mae also played the first, like, one of the first, like, co-ed. It was a white woman versus a black woman because they wouldn't play together, right? So they did a one-on-one and she won. So that's like the early legacies of Philadelphia basketball. And then we start getting into HBCUs once we get to the 40s, 50s, 60s, 70s. And this is where most of black women's basketball is played. So we're talking about Cheney, we're talking about Lincoln, you know, playing schools in Maryland, playing schools down south. And as all of that's happening, you got Coach Jones, who's coaching this incredible. You got the high school teams as well. That's where University High won their championships, and that was with Yolanda Lamy, which then puts us, you know, in, like, I think we're talking about the early 70s. So Yolanda Lamy comes along, goes to Cheney, then plays for Vivian Stringer, and they become the first HBU to make it to, like she said, she played in four Final Fours, four Elite Eight, and
she
four
Sweet 16.
She said it all casual, though.
She's no casual, very humble, but
very humble.
And what also brought me to the idea of the museum was kind of seeing all of these records. This person broke records. This person broke records. But these women have been holding record since before there was a three-point line, you know. So that means their points would be worth more in the record books than they are counted for in this moment. Then you get to the Cheryl Millers, and then you get into the Cynthia Coopers, the Cheryl Millers. And Cheryl Miller was actually too old to play pro, you know, and she's probably one of the greatest right up there with Lamy. So then, you know, the pros don't come until later, but then you have the American Basketball Association and things like that. But then, like Yolanda said, as she was coming up and coaching in the developmental league, young Dawn Staley comes on and she starts to coach Dawn Staley, and she could never know the impact in the history that Dawn Staley could make on women's basketball as a whole, on basketball as a whole, on like culture as a whole. We would never know how much Dawn Staley would impact the world, from her outfits to her style of coaching to her discipline. And that's why I had to say, okay, there needs to be an institution that recognizes the impact of specifically Black women's contribution to the game of basketball, because the history, I mean, all of that was just Philly. Like, I haven't even talked about California, New York, down South, like the women that have played South. So there's, you know, there's so much history, but Philadelphia, as far as basketball goes for women here, there is a long line of champion, a long legacy of what I see as disciplined and intentional basketball players. And I think it reflects, and like really raw. And I think it reflects the environment that you grow up in Philadelphia, which is why Shanita Landry was really key to the conversation as well the other day, because she was coached by Dawn Staley and then went on to play overseas for many years and then comes back to coach at Temple. And then they win a division championship her first year back. So again, and then that was with an all Black team and all Black coaching staff. So there's something to Philadelphia's Black culture that also has a long legacy of winning, of intentionality, and of hard work.
The history is so rich. Like, yes, there's so much history in just Philly alone. And like you said, let alone, we haven't even talked about all the other cities, but in women's basketball, and Philly has played such a role for, and Black women in Philly particularly has played such a role in women's basketball. And I know, I hope we get to this later, you know, in the conversation, but then like even to question whether or not Philly needs a team, it's like, whoa.
Right. Well, let's talk about it now. I mean, you brought it up, right? It feels like such a misstep on the part of the WNBA that we haven't had one yet, or to like think about that we may not make it in this round, even though the bid is in. From everything I'm reading and hearing and seeing, it seems like we might not get one this time. It's maddening. Yeah. It's such a mistake.
It's such a mistake from everything that Jay just shared, and then even to like the fans of Philadelphia sports wise, like, we're here. We will be here to support the WNBA team that gets here. And even like the pathway too, like how you all met at the Big Five Classic. Like, we have powerhouse organizations like the Novas, like the Temples, the Drexels, the LaSalle, all right here in Philly, So even that pathway to WNBA and the fan base, I mean, it's there. And then if you can you even think about like the rivalries? Like some, we would take our Hoopers girls to DC because that's the closest, or New York. But can you think about even some of those rivalries that would happen between
every
New York, Philly, and DC?
That comes to these watch parties, most of them, I have to say, are New York fans, but there are a lot of DC fans too. So they're giving their money to New York. They're giving their money to DC. They're buying tickets in New York. They're buying tickets to the games in DC. Like, we want to support this city and this team. We're already supporting the teams. So let's make it easier to do that and build on what we already have here. Yeah, it just, it makes perfect sense.
Yeah, and then bring the Maddie Seegers is back.
Yes.
Then bring the Natasha Cover.
Yes.
Bring them back. Copper.
Come on, Benai Jalini. Right. Come on.
Bring them back.
That's a super team right there. So all the Philly players. So it's Benai Jalini, Kalia Copper, Natasha Clown, Maddie Seegers. Who else? Alyssa Thomas. We could count her, I guess.
We'll take her, right?
Come on.
But speaking, so I feel like the league is being very particular that, like, these women are going to need lots of care and lots of resources just built in. I mean, and at Rival, they had a whole salon. They have the daycare. Like, I don't think that's necessarily happening at the level that it needs to in this city just yet. And I only know that because working for Philly Youth Basketball, I see the resources that go into making sure these young people are able to have what they need to play at their best abilities and to just be the best kids. There's a lot of programs that aren't able to feed their children. PYB feeds them when they come to program. If they need shoes, they have shoes. Yesterday, the girls just got a round of different clothing and sports gear for National Women's and Sports Day. So there's not that many programs that are actually really even given these resources to support the young people. So if that's a reflection of how we would support our professionals, I don't think, again, that Philly is ready necessarily to host a team because of the drama we just had with the arena and, you know, just gauging off of the resources that we have now. The only reason, another route I think we should go and that we could really get behind is there, and I've been doing more research on, is there are, you know, smaller semi-pro leagues. There's the American Basketball League. I forget what it's called, but, you know, New York has a team. Baltimore has a team. I've seen a bunch of teams on there, and Philly don't got a team. And that's like $100,000 investment. Versus a $100 million investment. I think where the city sits right now, we could put together $100,000. We can put together $250,000 to have a semi-pro team that then gets developed into what would be a professional team. You know what I mean? And then from there, really build the facilities and build the resources, because the two best practice spaces in the city right now is Leah Kors, which is Temple, and Philly, and the Six Man Center. So, you know, a lot of the kids where I used to coach in middle schools, they're not playing in gyms. They're playing in the cafeteria with like tape on the floor. So I know we can't have the best facilities all around and whoop, 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 and it takes a lot of investment and money, but let's put it there first. And then let's continue to build upon what the possibility is, because I would love a team here. Everyone would love a team here. It's a market that is untapped. So from a capitalism perspective, it's going to be great.
We'll see. I mean, my only hope is that when they build the stadium district, they build the new stadiums down there, that they'll take the women's basketball team into consideration, and then big, and that might help us along. But for now, I think you're right, which makes me very sad. All right, I think we're gonna wrap it up, but before we go, I'm gonna ask each of you a question. that I'm going to ask everybody as we finish up our podcast. So to you, and I think it's interesting that you're both Philly transplants, so we'll get a different perspective on this maybe, but what do you think makes Philly uniquely a women's sports town? And Randy, you go first.
If I learned anything about being an implant in Philly, I think it is the fan base that I think 110% would support our women's team. I mean, like, we hear it, and no matter what community I go into, it is, how do we get a women's basketball team here? The conversations are percolating, they're happening. The resources, to Denise's point, need to be there to match the interest. But I think it's the fan base. We saw it happen with women's soccer. Like, Philly fans are just top notch where they should be, no matter what sport it is. I think it's the fan base that I know will support a women's team here and will create those rivalries from DC up to New York. Yeah.
Agreed. All right, Jay, what about you? What do you think makes Philly uniquely a women's sports town?
I would say, going back to the history, because we have had some of the greatest women's athletes come out of Philadelphia, from baseball to tennis to, I mean, you name it. There's something about this city that makes great athletes, and they are an extension of this legacy. And having professional sports here will be an extension of that legacy, because that legacy can't just fall to the history book. You know, it can't just stop. Not saying that folks in NCAA and things like that are making history, but I think it will be a next step in that legacy for Philadelphia to have a professional sports team, whether it be soccer and or basketball.
Yeah, how do we get that education to the people, Jay? Because to your point, Philly is also that, like, big city, small town feel where, like, this is why I said the fan base, they're going to ride for there. Like, they are going to ride for the folks that come out of Philly, and to know also the education around where women's basketball has been is only going to amplify when we do get our team. So we got to get Black Women's Basketball Museum also
out there, right?
Out
yes.
there. We
and
need
you can come to.
To
any watch party and set up, do a pop-up museum. We would love to have you at our events. Start getting the word out anytime.
Cool. Yeah, I'm definitely working on it. I'm working on a couple different things, projects that can extend the knowledge a little bit more. And I think that's the goal of this year, is to, you know, continue to pop up with different places and make these partnerships grow so that, more history can come out there. But I wouldn't be mad if I just had a section of the new stadium that when you walk in, you just let the history on the way in.
There you go.
If whoever's listening,
let's make that happen.
The new stadium, left side.
Sounds good. All right, y'all. Thank you so much for joining me for episode 2. This has been fun.
Hoodoo.
In a world of cookie-cutter corporations and mass production, Stand Apart celebrates the bold and the truly original. Our goal in this segment is to put the spotlight on local businesses that defy expectations. Those that craft with passion, innovate with purpose, and bring something refreshingly different to their communities. From hidden gems to rising disruptors, we'll connect discerning listeners with local business owners that dare to stand apart. We hope you'll enjoy discovering the makers, the dreamers, and the visionaries here in Philadelphia who are redefining what it means to shop local.
All right, y'all, welcome. This is our first Stand Apart Small Business Spotlight. And today we have with us Mengistu Coiler from Two Locals. Two Locals has been supporting Watch Party essentially since the beginning. I know they just celebrated their 1-year anniversary. We are about to celebrate our 1-year anniversary next month. So we started around the same time, and they immediately jumped on board with having us come and do watch parties there. And it's just been so much fun. Great atmosphere, great beer, great food, and a really, really welcoming space. And so I'm here today with Gus and with Paul from Stand Apart. And we're going to ask you a few questions. You ready? Two Locals is celebrated as Philadelphia's first Black-owned brewery. Can you share the journey that led you to this milestone?
What led us to this journey? I would say Richard and I, my younger brother, we started homebrewing circa 2016. It was really his idea. You know, we always enjoyed beer. We love beer. We had a passion for it. Obviously, you have to like beer to get into to start homebrewing.
That's right up Paul's alley.
So he had the idea to start homebrewing. He bought a homebrew kit because I thought he was crazy, but he brought a homebrew kit and he made some, I think, what was it, English red ale. And he let me try it and I was like, okay, tastes like beer. And we gave away a lot of free beer, let people try the beer. And that built up our confidence. You know, we focus on, you know, a handful of styles, you know, a pale ale, probably the easiest style we started off with, made a brown ale. Circa 2018, we entered a homebrew contest and got second place for our brown ale, which we called Nubian.
Very cool.
We got second place on a coin flip. So I think we got first place. You know, I'm just going to go ahead and say that we won it. But yeah, people started asking us whenever they had events, hey, can you bring some of your homebrew? We're able to allow people to taste more of the beer. And we're just on this journey of just, you know, making beer at home and letting people try it. And we eventually started, you know, going into the industry, going into breweries, meeting folks. Just like any sort of industry, you know, you want to go and meet the people that are actually doing it for a living and the people that have quote unquote made it. And we formed those relationships and just kept plugging away. And I'd say around 2019, we started thinking about how we could start fundraising, because starting a brewery is really expensive. It's capital intensive, equipment, you know, in a six-figure range, sometimes $250,000 even just to buy that equipment. And the average person doesn't have it. 2019, early 2020, we started a Kickstarter, and we all know what happened in Q1 of 2020. Kickstarter started to do well, but I'd say about 3 weeks in, the whole world shut down because of, you know, probably don't have to say it, but pandemic and people were losing their lives, losing jobs. So we shut that down. And that same year in 2020, the whole George Floyd situation happened. And one thing about the brewing industry is that it's a loving industry for the most part. People like to come together and brew beer and raise funds for initiatives that they truly believe in. So there's an owner of a brewer and a co-owner of a brewery in San Antonio, Texas, Marcus Baskerville, that had the idea to come up with a beer called Black is Beautiful. And he was able to get a bunch of breweries to sign up to brew this beer, which was a stout, you know, a dark beer. And everyone used the same label. And it was great because it helped us to raise funds for various initiatives focused around people of color. So we did a collab with Love City Brewing in 2020 and raised some money and donated that money to the Philly Bell Fund and BLM Philly.
Nice.
So it just, you know, that speaks to the industry and sort of the collaborative nature of the industry and how everyone really tries to help out and look out for each other. And just doing that collab and other collabs helped us get our name out in the industry, helped raise awareness for us, gave us some visibility. And that sort of just, I don't want to say catapulted us, but it did help us on our journey to, as we started talking to landlords and talking to banks and investors. And then later on that year, we met our current landlord through a broker, went through the lease process, went through the design process, broke ground in May of 2023. And in January of 2024, we opened up our brick and mortar and University City section of West Philly. Rich and I are originally from West Philly. We're raised in West Philly in what's now called the Cedar Park neighborhood, West Philly, 51st and Catherine. So we're very intentional and deliberate about wanting to be in West Philadelphia for our first brick and mortar. And we just celebrated our 1 year anniversary, January 31st of 2025. It's been a long, hard year opening up a small business especially a brewery is not easy. It's very, very difficult. A lot of blood, sweat, and tears went into this, but we're here. We survived the first year, and we're trying to make year two even better.
Nice. And so it is Black History Month. What does it mean to you guys that you are the first Black-owned brewery in the city of Philadelphia? Because when I heard that, I thought that was crazy that you guys are the first, but amazing at the same time.
Yeah, there always has to be a first, you know, something. It's just, you know, a life happens. We're very proud of it, but that's not all. We want to see more folks that look like us in the industry. We want to see more diversity, more people of color, more women in the industry. It's not easy. And sometimes these things, you know, happen just because of the dynamics of just how the world is set up. There are certainly gatekeepers, but sometimes people just don't think and aren't thoughtful about how they can make the world more inclusive and more diverse. But I hope that others look at us as inspiration. Certainly we've had inspiration, you know, maybe not necessarily from the industry, but from seeing other people break barriers. But the work has just begun, you know, like that. It feels like there's a lot of work to get here, but the work has really just begun. Like I said before, it's not easy opening up a small business, and we're doing a lot of collaborative things, you know, partner up with you guys, with Watch Party. We're so grateful to have you guys partner up with us and support our business. And we're happy to support you guys. We're always looking for more partnerships and just, you know, how to grow our business and just be more inclusive. You know, everybody can win together, you know,
yep,
you know, absolutely. Teamwork together, everyone achieves more. So I think we can make that happen.
Definitely. All right, Paul, you're up.
Well, I'm from Ireland, so I'm always fascinated with the immigrant story. And I've always been noticing in your beer menus and in your food menu with Liberty Kitchen there, you've got a lot of Liberian dishes, like Liberian rice and beans, so your snacks. I think a while back you did the Liberian dish of the week. So like, how do these dishes and the beers, like sort of Nubian, reflect your heritage, Gus? And how important is it for you to incorporate your cultural background in the brewery's offerings?
It's very important. It's very important. I mean, the craft beer industry, there's a lot of creatives, right? Like it's a craft, right? Not to sound cheesy, but my brother's very creative. He comes up with a lot of the names and the ideas of the beers. But one thing we've noticed in the industry is while, you know, we love beer and breweries, it doesn't represent us. We go to these breweries and these establishments. So what we wanted to bring was our own flavor to the industry. I think that diversity and having different flavored palates is a good thing. So we wanted to lean in on our culture, you know, West African, West Indian background. I was actually born in Liberia in West Africa. I came to this country when I was 7. So we grew up culturally just on those flavors, right? Scotch bonnet peppers, habanero peppers, a lot of jasmine rice, a lot of garlic, a lot of onions. And, you know, we're from West Philly. We're from Philly. So we grew up on the Black culture that's in Philly. So one of our beers is called Good John. John is a word that I like to say is they gentrified John 2025. But that's a word that I grew up on, you know, like as a kid. We said John all the time. So we just like to lean in on that culture of ours and bring it to the forefront.
Yeah, yeah. That Good John beer is one of my favorites. Like we were hosting a watch party like the night before the Super Bowl. So there was no one there, but you had two great bartenders on and my girlfriend and I. We must have went through 10 or 12 pints of the Good John. It's pretty solid stuff. So, you know, like what's the most rewarding aspect of operating two locals and what's the future plans for the brewery? So I know the first year is always the most critical. And if you survive that, like you're on a real good trajectory. So what are the most rewarding aspects now of getting through that year in getting...
Yeah, I mean, I'd say the most rewarding aspect for me personally is meeting our followers and seeing them come back over and over and telling me that they love being there, they love the spot. That's rewarding for me. Me and my wife, just the way we grew up, you know, we had a lot of family gatherings and having people over and sort of serving, right? And entertaining people. And it's fun. I love, you know, when we have the drinks flowing and the food and everyone's laughing and having a good time, I always love that. So to see that in the space is probably the most rewarding thing for me. Obviously, we have bills to pay, so we got to focus on making money. But that's, for me, it's the most rewarding thing, is to see people in my establishment just absolutely happy and having a good time and knowing that they could come there and be unbothered. You know, like, they could do whatever they want, do whatever they want to a certain extent, but no one's going to bother them. You come in there, sit, have a drink. No one's bothering you. You can come with whoever you want and have a good time. And that's what I want. You know, that's what I've experienced every
time I've been there. Right. And that's why we keep coming back.
Thank you. And we just want to keep building on what we have, right? So we have different partnerships and sponsorships that we're doing, but we want to keep that going. I think, like, for me, from what I've learned, you need a community to sustain your business, right? And mm-hmm. and having that following is huge. So we're trying to build where we are, right? Like, West Philly is where we are. You know, we'd love to get more people in that ecosystem coming to our establishment and being a place that people in the neighborhood want to come and support. Now, where we're located is a bit of a transient area, but there are people that live in that area. You know, you have a lot of grad students that come in to Drexel and Penn for 2 to 4 years and then leave, and that's fine. But once they come here, I want them to know that, hey, Tuolumne is the spot that I want to go to and be and hang out. And whether I stay in Philly or leave Philly, I could tell people that that was a great place.
Yep.
So that's really where we are. You know, we want to just keep building on that momentum and just keep growing our following.
Thanks for listening to this episode of the Watch Party PHL podcast. A special shout out to Stand Apart, sponsor of the Watch Party PHL podcast and supporter of women's sports in Philly. Please give us a follow or subscribe wherever you listen to your podcasts. Follow us on Instagram. And remember to watch and talk about women's sports. Let them know everybody watches and listens to this dawn. See you at the next Watch Party.